Hello, everybody. I'm Jamie Bjorklund. I'm with the HR team, and I wanted to just come and steal a couple minutes before your class starts. So what I wanted to talk about a little bit is our ASE program. Many of you know about the Application Support Engineer program, but I think we've had a little bit of confusion around, like, well, I'm in the PCP program, or I'm already registered, so I think I'm in ASE. Wait, am I in ASE? What? I have no idea what's going on. So I brought some information about the ASE program. I'm just going to leave them up here on the desk. I hope you don't mind. Feel free to just grab it on your way out if you want more information. And the quick version is the ASE program was started in 2009 as a means of helping folks who are in TS and other technical roles who wanted a pathway into development. They felt like they had picked their major incorrectly and were regretting it. And so it was our way of giving people the educational foundation and then the experience here to be able to be considered for a move into development, although many people move into the application support engineer role and decide to stay there because it gets them exactly where they were hoping to go. So it's sort of up to you to help chart that course a little bit, but I know many people are taking these classes we're offering from the UW as part of their ASE program, and I just don't want there to be people out there who are assuming, oh, I registered for the class, I'm taking it, that must mean I'm in the ASE program. You do have to go through a separate approval for that. And basically that separate approval, it goes through the in here kind of what the whole program requires. But basically you're just going to email me to get started in the program. And again, I'm Jamie Bjorklund. It's a terrible last name, I know. I downgraded. It was Swanson. It's been downhill ever since. So Bjorklund is B-J-O-R-K, but it's just Jamie at Epic. So I'll leave this up front. And then feel free to let me know if you have any questions along the way. And don't tell my husband who works in EDI. I said all that about his name.
All right, so my name is Mike Epley. I know some of your faces. I'm a developer here at Epic. I'm also a very proud UWCS alum. And so I just wanted to kind of take this moment to introduce myself as someone that's going to be more involved in the coordination and planning for the UWCS classes going forward, especially coming up this summer. I'm also kind of the point of contact between Epic and UW, specifically the UWCS department. So I have a lot of relations with them, and I would encourage you, if you have any questions about a lot of these classes I've taken, I recognize this chart already, so I'm excited about that. But if you guys have any questions about the CS program in general, feel free to reach out to me as well.
Great.
Sounds. Am I on? It's working. Cool. Well, first of all, as an outsider, let me congratulate you. The day after I taught my first class last week, I opened the newspaper and I read all about the Mayo Clinic. Now, I'm sure many of you say, well, that was not me. That was somebody higher up. But it's a team win, I would say. And it's always nice to be associated with winners. It's sort of like sports teams for you go around for everybody that's wearing a Packers hat, and of course, this is Wisconsin, so that's to be expected. You see very few people outside my old home team, which was the Buffalo Bills. I think in my entire tenure here, which has been way longer than many of you have been alive, I don't think I've ever seen a Bills hat in Wisconsin. Because what's the thing about the Bills? Well, they went to the Super Bowl four consecutive times, and they lost four consecutive times. And what really was torture about it is each game they played, they lost worse than the previous year. So by the fourth year, you say, never again, I can't take this. So I wanted to congratulate you on that. Also, I had some questions about audio recording. And apparently, audio recording is automatic. I didn't even know it was happening, but it is. So we're going to try to make the lectures last time and this and current and forward ones available to you. Kind of sets me to wondering, though, with all these invisible recordings. If I walk over here and say something bad about Judy, does that little trap door open and send me down to the guard tower or something to have my attitude readjusted? I hope not, but it's always a little interesting when you see the future and say, I didn't even know, you know, that the recorder was on, and all of a sudden it's all there for posterity. So I have to be a little more careful in the jokes I tell and whoever else I laugh at, because they may be listening and come back to me in future. So first thing I want to do is, first of all, any questions from the class, the projects, the material from last time? So one of the things I did, and I sent out mail to Piazza about this, was that I put up last week's notes online so you can access them in printed form. The reason I don't have these available in printed form immediately is I usually prepare some last-minute ideas just before class. So many of these were written an hour or two ago, and it's really not convenient to scan them and copy them and all. But they will be available, and I think you'll find this useful. So let me talk a little bit about the project. And again, I was talking about Piazza. So most of you have been in contact with Piazza. If you haven't signed up, it's the case that you may have gotten an email request. Please answer it. It's a good idea to check Piazza from time to time because they'll answer questions that you may have yourself. If you haven't gotten a request from Piazza, that means you're not on the list. You should check with me. I'll take your email address, put you on the list, and Piazza will send you an email saying, please sign up if you care to. Then what happens is periodically, if there's business in the class, you'll get some email saying, here was a message. You can look at it immediately or not, but there's a good chance that other students may be asking, or more importantly, answering questions that you have. So it's to your benefit. It's certainly to my benefit. So that being the case, let me get to the Project One notes I started today. Have all of you, at least this stage, started to the extent of taking the startup package I gave you and putting it on your machine so that you have it in front of you ready to go? The reason I say that is the best way to do this, and it's not cheating, it's not unintended, is to take what I've given you and modify it. One of the misleading factors that when you first learn programming is this notion of writing a program from scratch. You do that for tiny programs, a sort program, or a little binary tree manipulating software. But real software is almost always done from a starting point with something already existing. That's true not just in programs, it's true in all sorts of documents. In fact, it's always the case when I write a letter of recommendation. After I write the letter, I have to double check to make sure it's for the student in question and to the recipient in question. It's always embarrassing if I send a letter to, say, University of Chicago saying Mary Jones was the best student I ever had at Cornell. But no, who was it and all that? So that gets a little embarrassing. I'm sure you've had similar things. So what we'll be doing for this and all the remaining projects, there'll be five steps. This is the first, is I'll give you a startup that will do part of your project for you correctly. And of course, the design and so on is meant to be correct. So in this stage, I've given you something that takes a CSX Lite program, scans it, we'll talk more about that, parses it, we'll talk more about that, builds an abstract syntax tree. That's the structure that really defines what a program is, and analyzes it. What I've given you does a very simple analysis. It goes ahead and walks the tree and simply counts for each scope, how many declarations were in that scope and how many uses were in that scope. That's not quite what you want as your solution. But the notion of walking the tree is the same. So the first point to be made is what's mostly unchanged. What this means is you can go into the AST and look for all the calls that have to something called count decals and uses. You're going to have a different name for yours because you're not counting declar and uses. You're creating this identifier cross-listing. But every place there's a call in the existing code for my routine, there'll be a similar call for your routine. So that means you can look at the AST nodes, but you don't have to analyze them super carefully. The structure to walk you through the whole AST is there. Nothing bogus about that. It starts at the root, then visits the left child, the right child, and recursively works all the way down. When it hits a leaf, that is a node with no children, it returns its way up. And eventually, every node, every statement, every item in the program gets touched and analyzed. So that's good. It's kind of hard when you don't understand fully an AST to figure out what do I go where and when? And I understand that, so that's to help you make sure that you don't make a mistake in traversing the tree. So that's good, but I can't be all that generous today, so what do I give you? What haven't I given you? And the thing that's changed is the data structure that you're going to have to build. At the end, you have to print something out, but all that printing is essentially a human-readable version of the data structure you built. What is it? It's a cross-reference index. I'll talk more about it in just a moment. But That means, oh, wait, I've got to create a data structure. That means I've got to decide if I'm going to have a list or a tree, what fields I'm going to have, who's connected to whom, and so on. How do I figure that out? And it turns out that a good way to do it is use a well-established precedent in engineering, science, technology called reverse engineering. That is, you take something that you know works and take it apart, look at it, analyze it, and figure out how it was put together. Now, are any of your products been reverse engineered by competitors? It's certainly a temptation. In fact, there's a great story about an unbelievable case of reverse engineering. During World War II, the United States flew B-29 bombers in the Pacific from island bases to Japan. Occasionally, one of the bombers would get in trouble, run out of fuel, be damaged, and it would try to land on safe territory. And one of those happened to be the Soviet Union, Vladivostok, the eastern areas. But a funny thing was that Russia, Soviet Union at that time, was not at war with Japan. So our pilots could land there. They wouldn't be shot or anything, but they were interred. So the pilots were interred, and okay, that means they can't leave, they can't participate. But it turns out that the B-29s, after the war ended, were not returned. Why weren't they? The Soviets actually took, there was a total of four of them, and took them apart piece by piece, bolt by bolt, panel by panel, reverse engineered them, and built their own bomber, which looked an awful lot like a B-29. It was called a Tupolev 4, and you can look it up in Wikipedia. And they so reverse engineered it that although the Soviets were metric, like all of Europe and most of the world, the parts in that particular plane were imperial, you know, inches and yards and feet, not millimeters and centimeters and so on. So what they did, you know, was an extreme case, but it's a good principle sometime, and I'll show you how to reverse engineer the data structure that you need from what I'm asking you to produce. So the input, and this is exactly what I showed you before, is a very simple program. It shows an integer and a Boolean declaration, an if statement, and an assignment built into the if. So you'll be given a correct AST for that. And what you have to produce at the very end, after you walk the AST, is a data structure that consists of a number of lines. What does one line represent here? Well, it represents all the information you gather about a single declaration. So, aha, you immediately figure out two things, namely, my primary item on a per-line basis has to be oriented around declarations. Why do I know that? Well, this line number here is the line number on which the declaration occurred. So this is 1 and 2, not because they're first two, but rather because this is line 1 and that's line 2. If I would have had both of them on the same line, which is legal and possible, they both would have had line 1 as their home base. So that's there. The name is obviously extracted from the declaration, and the type is extracted from the declaration. What's not extracted from the declaration is the remaining information. This represents all the places where that identifier is used. We don't know how many that's going to be. Could be zero, could be a lot. So you need some flexible data structure. Something like a list is certainly a possibility, and in fact, that's what I do in my solution. So this one item is some fields, a line number, an identifier name, and a type name, and a list of uses, zero more. But I can have many of those. So this particular item, call it ID info perhaps, would be a list of ID infos, and each time I see a new identifier, a new one is added at the end. Now, of course, the thing is, how do I add these line numbers? Those come later. This is where, remember, we talked about having a symbol table. Even if we didn't have scoping, you'd still need some way of saying, previously, there was a declaration. I got to find where that guy is because I have to register myself. This, for example, shows A appears twice on line 4. This says B appears once at line 3. I have to go backwards and add that information. That comes later because as we're walking the tree, we're essentially visiting lines in numeric order, line 1, line 2, line 3, and finally line 4. So you have to have some way of finding your way back. And one way of doing that would be having a mapping of some sort. One way to do that is a hash table. But because we have the rules of scoping, it turns out that we may have more than one legal declaration of an identifier. In our simple language, the rule is only one identifier per scope, but different scopes may redefine the same identifier. That's standard in programming languages. And it turns out that the most recent declaration, the innermost one, is the one that counts. So I had some notes about that. Let me get back to those. So that means one of the things you'll have to add that I'm not giving you is a block structured symbol table. And this is almost, but not quite the same as before. And what that means is as you're recognizing declarations, you're putting them in a table. Each scope, remember, a scope represents a curly brace to a matching curly brace. They nest. So an inner scope can appear within an outer scope. And these can nest as deeply as you care to do it. Each one of those will have a table. That table will be indexed by the name of an identifier. That's simply a string. And what all do you imagine it might point to? A table usually says, is something declared or not? If it's not declared, I get a null reference. That's its way of saying, no, didn't find it. If it does find something, what would be a reasonable thing for it to give you back? As saying, yeah, tell me something about B. Here's the information you wanted about B. What would be a reasonable thing to have that table return? The answer, of course, is, getting back to the right place, this data structure. Again, we'll call it perhaps the ID info. So each time I create one of these ID infos, I fill in the information to the left straight away, and I put it in a table indexed by the name of the identifier. It says if anybody cares about identifier A, it looks it up in the table, it gets a reference to this structure, and what it can then do is call methods that say, hey, I'd like to register myself as a use. And one way to do that is just imagine a list of line numbers that's appended to at the end. So the lowest numbers come first, the higher numbers come last. Maybe zero of those or maybe more. In the case of multiple identifiers on the same line, I use the subscript notation. You don't have to do that. If you prefer to say 4, 4, that's perfectly acceptable. It's a matter of taste of which you think is more readable or more elegant. But it's not important enough that I would deduct points from it or the TA. So you're going to need to have tables, and they're going to be linked together because you have this nesting rule. So what you do is each time I open a scope, when do I open a scope? When I start at the top of the program, the CSX light node, or a block, because a block is an inner structure that's allowed to have declarations. So when I see one of those, I say initially, hey, I'm opening a new scope, I need a new table. Initially, of course, it's empty. And I'll put the inner scope at the head of a list. That is, that'd be the first one I try. So if I had a program similar to what I show here, I'd have two scopes. The inner one would say, here's the information about B. So it'd point to this line and say it's at line 1, 2. It's a Boolean, its name is B. And when I see this reference, please add that line number to that ID info. If I see an A, it would try the inner scope, because I might have redeclared A. That would have been legal, but I chose not to do it. So I go to the outer scope, and I find A there and say, okay, here's the use of A. This is the identifier that's an integer A, line number 1, and here's the use of it at line 3. And that's what you need to do. When you leave a scope, that is when you've walked the entire subtree pertaining to a block, you can throw its hash table away. The rule is outside of a scope, the identifiers are not accessible, and hence the hash table is not needed. Anybody who's going to be using a hash table has used it, and the linkage is no longer needed. You don't really have to throw it away, but logically, it's thrown away. It's no longer needed. And when you get down to the end of the main program, you've walked the entire tree, you can throw away the global symbol table, because it's no longer needed. What you then do is, I'll go back to the notes we were looking at a moment ago. At that stage, you have a data structure representing this, and all you do is make it into human-readable form. A good way to do that is have two string methods for each of the structures and substructures you make. A two string says, here's something, and I'd like you to put it in string-like format. Well, how do I get this two-dimensional effect? That's easy. I can append new line characters. And a new line character means I have one long string, but when it's printed out, every time I hit a new line, it'll bop down to the next line and give me a two-dimensional effect. So this doesn't have to be anything fancy. It can just be a big, long string with new lines at appropriate places. So each one of these will be produced when I take one ID info and two-string it. And what would toString do? It would print out the line number, print out the colon, print out the name, print out the parens, get the type name for the type, and then walk the list of all the guys who have registered themselves as users of this identifier and print those out one by one. And you can print commas and all that. You know, it's a little bit of programming detail, but it's not all that hard. And once this guy's done, you say, do I have any more guys in my list? If so, I append the new line and visit that guy and keep doing that until I'm at the end of the list. When I'm at the end of the list, I'm done. I return and voila, I give back to my original caller a nice string representation of this cross index. And you do that and your job's done. And the nice thing about this is that it's pretty easy to visualize from a program like this what's expected. So if, in fact, you do have any errors, they're errors that'll probably be pretty easy for you to recognize and fix. So any questions about what I'm asking for? Okay, free for nothing, I'm going to give you one of the great insights of programming and developing, something that's one of the rare universal truths. And what this is, there's two ways to do programming, the right way and the wrong way, of course. But let me tell you about the wrong way first. And every language, every application, every program has this potential problem. The wrong way to do any big project, this is not a particularly big project, but it's non-trivial, is the wrong way is to write all the code first, then get it through the compiler, get all the compiler errors out, and then finally debug it. For a small to medium-sized program, it's not horrible if you do it that way, but it's not the best. For a huge program, it's the kiss of death if you do it that way. And I don't care what language it is, I don't care what the problem is, it's the wrong way of doing it. The question is why? Why is this universally wrong? What's the bad thing that happens if you do a program that way? Well, that's right. That's right. So if you have a big program, you say, I don't know quite what's going wrong. It might have been this guy, but it may have been somebody else in getting to me. So if, for example, something about identifiers is messed up, maybe it has to do with somebody who had to walk the tree and get you to that identifier screwing up. You don't know. So you have nothing that has confidence. The alternative, the way we'll do it in this class almost naturally, and I think experienced developers know this from bitter experience, is you do a development bit by bit. In this case, here's a good way to start. Namely, just do declarations first. Forget about this business about symbol tables and identifier uses immediately. You'll need to do it, but not immediately. And just go ahead and do the part that walks the tree processing only declarations. So effectively, you'll be producing just that much of the data structure. But that part should be correct. So you can walk through a number of programs and say, yeah, at each point I got the correct number, the correct name, and the correct type, and I didn't miss any declarations. And I didn't misinterpret something as a declaration that wasn't. That's not too hard. You can probably do that in an hour or two, depending on how comfortable you are programming. And you've got something working. So now you know the declarations are working and that these data structures are probably pretty much correct. You then go ahead and say, I'll go to the next piece, which is the identifier uses, and say, okay, as I go along, I'm going to need to build this symbol table. If you want, you can start out with only programs that have one scope. That means you don't have to worry about a chain of symbol tables, just have one. And look up for there, say, okay, find the identifier name, look them up in the table. Remember, we guarantee you that we won't test you on any incorrect programs. So if I use identifier A, it will be properly declared in some scope. You can guarantee that for yourself too. And once you do that, you find the identifier, you append it to the right ID info, and go ahead and test that out, including creating the toString so you can look at it. Once that works, okay, if I can do one scope, let's try nested scopes. Go from one scope to two or three. And once you have that running, bingo, it's all working. And now, if something goes wrong, you have a good idea of where it's going wrong. For example, if you're having trouble with the declarations, it can't be anything going around with the uses because you're not even doing those yet. So those can't be the problem. It's got to be the declarations. Once the declarations are working, then you can focus on the uses. The declarations aren't too worrisome because they're correct. You've tested, you've looked at the output, and it's pretty sound. Sure, there might be some subtle error you missed. That's always a chance. But this way, you always focus on a little bit. I just put it in, just fresh in my mind. I think I know how it's working. Test it. And that is a much better way of doing it. And as we go through the rest of the semester, each case, you'll be able, because this is a compiler, do a similar thing. You'll first only handle, for scanning, simple tokens, then more complex ones, and finally, any and all tokens that might appear. I'll start talking about that today, and that'll be your next project, and that'll be out in a couple of weeks. I guess this project's due 2 weeks from today, so the next project could be released prior to that. So I wanted to talk about that for sure. Something else you may have noticed, and the Piazza chatter noticed that too, and says, hey, wait a minute, he's asking me to test with CSX Lite programs, but I'm not at all clear what CSX Lite programs are. Guess what? That's one of the great problems in human life, is that a lot of things you're asked to do are not very carefully defined. Situation there. When I come in here around 5 o'clock, I notice lots of people leaving, and many of them are in nice cars. That's a good sign. That means you have generous bosses. Now, I don't go to Verona very often. I live in Fitchburg and go to Madison more often. Are there any traffic stops here where they try to get you for going through stop signs or speeding or anything like that? You know, speed traps, they call them. Okay, that's on 151? Yeah, okay. I guess that might be the case. So you got to learn about that. I oftentimes go to the Oshkosh Air Show. And there's a little town on the route from Madison to Oshkosh called Rosendale. And I see at least one guy bopping his hands. Rosendale is the world's worst speed trap. You're going in the middle of nowhere road with this 40 or 45. All of a sudden, they show you speed limit 25, and they start enforcing it within a few feet of that sign. So I don't know if anybody's ever been hit by Rosendale. But so there's a case where the rules are strictly enforced. Other places, not so much so. So one of the things we're going to learn when we're developing a compiler is we need a precise definition of what's valid and what's not. And we're going to do that not by having an exhaustive English language specification, but we'll actually develop notation and formalism that will say very precisely what an identifier looks like, what a literal looks like, what any token looks like, and later on, what sequences of tokens are valid and what are invalid. So just like in human life, there are certain patterns that are valid and other patterns that are invalid. So if I say, you know, I walk the dog, that's fine. If I say the dog walked I, what is that? That's Yoda, and I happen to be parking in the Yoda parking thing, so it kind of rubs off on me. I think they have subliminal things there and all that. So there are various rules about how you put things together and how you're not. Later on, we'll learn about how to understand what sequence of words make sense and which don't. So for example, if I say, Harry likes Java, does that make sense? Well, it turns out who Harry is. You may be Harry. You may have a neighbor named Harry. I used to have a cat named Harry, and he didn't like Java. But wait a minute. What Java? There's all kinds of Java. There's the programming language Java. Believe me, he didn't know anything about that. There's also the liquid Java, which some people like and some don't. But cats will taste anything, but they don't like coffee. You know, that's one thing that's not high on their list. Or it might have been the island in Indonesia called Java, but he never got sent there. And so I don't know about that. So we're going to try to figure out what makes sense and what makes not. And that's not always easy. I don't know, when you went to school, did you ever have the poem Jabberwocky? Mimsy were the Booger Gills or something like that, and you may know more of it. It was even worse when I was taking college German. There's a German version of that. Anybody here fluent in German? I don't remember what it was. Yeah, what was its name of it? So our instructor gave us that. And here I am, and it's just like Jabberwocky, but in German, and I only half understood German anyway. I was within this close of killing the instructor when I found out what was going on, because I was trying all kinds of declinations and lookups, and nothing made any sense. Well, we're going to do a similar thing in programming languages, that when you write a program, even though it looks normal and is comprised of normal symbols, it may not make sense. And one of the things we have to do is decide, is this nonsensical enough that I must disallow it? Or should I allow it? And that's one of the cases, like hops, we'll have to kind of make the rules on the go. So the rules are vague, and we're going to have to make them more precise. One of the advantages of doing that is we'll have some automatic help in building components of our compiler, particularly the scanner and later the parser. Unfortunately, the later components are much tougher, and those are cases where they're subject to some level of ambiguity. We talked a little bit about that last time with the fact that some languages allow identifier names to be overloaded. That means same name can mean multiple things. One of the better uses of that is on constructors. In a class, you can have multiple constructors that differ on the name, the number or type of their parameters. Some languages allow the same name to be used for different purposes. A class, a constructor. I believe in Java, you can use the same name for a method and I think for a local variable. And I'll have a slide about that in future. But the more of that you allow, the harder it is to analyze, is this a meaningful program or not? Because a person may be meaning one thing or another. So if I said Harry like Java, even if Harry were a human, what Java am I talking about? Is he a gung-ho programmer? Is he a great coffee drinker? Maybe he took a vacation in Java and liked it. If you saw South Pacific, Bali High is somewhere near Java. And Bali High was supposed to be a great place. So maybe, you know, he wanted to go back there and enjoy himself. One of the things I also wanted to mention is that I talked about ASTs. And even though we don't know about parsing yet, we can get some information unexpectedly, perhaps, from an AST. And that is, if the tree allows something, it's potentially legal. If the tree does not allow it, it's almost certainly illegal. And reading through Piazza, I had a perfectly good question over the weekend, namely, is it possible to have something like this? Good point, thanks. That's a case where I intermixed declarations with uses. So the question is that legal? Well, I didn't tell you in English, so it's a little bit vague, but you can kind of reverse engineer again from the structure. If you look at CSX Lite ASTs, they have one subtree that says, I'm all the decals, and this one says, I'm all the statements. And guess what? That means once I go from the decals to a statement, I've got no more place to put decals. So it turns out because this structure is required, this is not. And we'll talk about this. Oh, gee, what if I wanted that? Well, if you really wanted it, you could have it. All you do is use the scoping stuff. So you can have it if you want it, but you have to do it my way rather than your way. It's my language, so I get to make the rules. That's one of the cool things about having your own language. You make the rules, and everybody else has to obey them. Couple of other points that I wanted to make, and then we'll get to the regular lecture, is if you decided you want to do extra credit, that means you wanted to handle two common errors that we don't require you handle, but still can be handled and probably should in a more realistic system. That is the case where there's an undeclared identifier. You make a reference to something and there's no declaration for it. That's fairly common. Sometimes people write code first and add declarations later. I'm sure none of you would ever do that. But if you did do that and forgot to add the declaration, you get that error. It's also the case that occasionally someone will have a multiple declaration in the same scope that's illegal. So ignoring overloading, it's simply not allowed. And the second declaration is illegal given the first one. And you'd have to catch that and somehow say, hey, wait a minute, you're trying to declare this guy, but it already is declared in the scope. So you'd want to be able to have a way of handling that. Okay, and I think that's all you had there. And now what's happened is my machine has gone to sleep. Here we go. But now I have to trick it by unplugging and replugging. I think that will work. Please, please, please. Yeah, good, good. Okay, so where we left last time was I was going ahead and talking about, let's see, I just want to make sure that we're timing is right, all fine. So it's a situation there that we were looking at the overall structure, and I've just been talking about that. So let's go back to the diagram and then a little bit more detail about each of these components. The reason I want to have you understand these now is because I'll be talking about them in passing, and as the semester progresses, you'll actually be doing them. And I don't want you to be confused as to what these things are and why they exist. So at the upper left, yeah, right here, your program's coming in. And at this level, the input is unbelievably simple. It's perhaps too simple, but that's a holdover to the old programming days. Perhaps some of you have seen old movies or TV shows where people interact with a computer and they have like a ticker tape coming out that is a long piece of tape where characters would be printed out one by one by one on a long tape. In the old days, they actually had computers produce output that way. It was a holdover from the old ticker tapes like they had on stock exchanges where the quotes for the various stocks would come out in a linear sequence. It seems unbelievably primitive given all the fancy stuff we have now. But it turns out programs could be entered in exactly that same way. All the common programming languages that exist, C, Java, C++, Fortran, and lots of others, you could simply write one continuous line and enter them. You don't even need to have line breaks. Normally, line breaks are there for human readership, not for input. So you can imagine this in the most primitive possible way of a sequence of characters on a ticker tape, character by character by character, blank, A, B, blah, 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 blah. And from this, a complex structure has to be inferred. So our very first component, the one we'll be doing in our next assignment, and as I said, I think I may mention that passing, is the second assignment is posted already, so those of you who have already done assignment one or want to get ahead because you're planning to be away at some point, that's available for you to get and look at. And between classes at breaks, you can go ahead and take a look at a copy I printed out. So we'll be doing a scanner, and I'll talk more about that later today. What comes out is not individual characters, but the individual words of a programming language. The words of a programming language are things like reserved words, like if and end. Things like numbers, literals. Things like identifiers, like ABC or cost of a dozen. Delimiters, like commas and semicolon, parentheses, braces, and all the rest. We'll declare exactly what's legal, and we'll declare how you form it, what's legal and what's not. In many cases, you say it's pretty simple. Other cases, it's not quite as simple, and it takes a little bit of detail to do things right. So we'll talk about that. That'll be your second assignment. These tokens, then, are now a linear stream. They're not individual characters, but they're individual words. So you can imagine it's almost like one of these translation programs that translates word by word. So occasionally, and some of these are pretty cool. I occasionally, I don't know what happened, but I'm on a mailing list for somebody in Poland. And I speak a little German, speak a little French, get a little Spanish, but absolutely no Polish. And I'm always wondering whether they're offering me something that's obscene or illegal or something that's completely legal. But now, of course, there are enough translation programs that you can go ahead and have it translate either entirely or word by word. And usually they're pretty legal things. They're just things I wouldn't be interested in. Plus, I'm not going to go all the way to Poland to get something if I can avoid it. But so what the parser will do is start making sense out of individual words. Here's where we'll get the structure. So we'll say, Harry likes Java, Java likes the Harry, because that's the wrong order. And that's the sort of things that a parser knows about. A lot of the details of programming are in the parser, and here's where you get a sense of what's legal and what's not. And now here's where you first start getting some power. If some of you thought, hey, if I owned my programming language, I would do it this way or I would do it that way. Once you start writing your own compiler, you can have your own variation of a programming language. In fact, many corporations, I don't know if this one, I mean, certainly you have your own language with Cache, which I think not too many other people use. But many organizations have their own variety of well-established programming languages. They might not have strictly kosher C or C++ or Java. Might be the basic language with a little bit added in. Now, why would you go ahead and do that if you were a manager at one of these companies? What's the advantage of adding in a few features to an existing language? I can say a little louder. That no one else built. That's right. And since nobody else built it, suppose that some nasty guy decides to sneak in the middle of the night and steal the program this gentleman just wrote with his new feature. Of course, they stole the program, but they didn't steal the compiler. They didn't know enough to do that. And they start running through their compiler, and what happens? It's like, Mimsy, we're the Burger Gills or something like that. It ain't going to work. And even though 90 or 95% of it is valid, that other 5 or 10% that's not is enough to really deter somebody from doing it. So there's some sense in doing that. And you can, if you want, start inventing your own variation on languages. There are disadvantages, too, because if you have a buddy who doesn't have your compiler, you can't ship your modified program. So it's a two-way street. You can't give anything away that you want to, but stealing's a lot harder. So then we'll get down to the type checker. And the type checker is where we start answering some questions like, if it's illegal to have the same declaration of an identifier, I can't say int A, semicolon, boolean A, semicolon, who's going to enforce that? You would think at first blink that the parser might enforce it. The answer is no. The parser doesn't know about the details of identifiers. He knows there's something called an identifier, and he knows those are spelled all kinds of crazy ways. But it does not pay attention to the exact spelling and the exact rules about what may be used or not used. So what happens is the next phase, the type checker is the guy that does that. It's the one that says, does this kind of make sense? This is a spot where we say, Harry likes Java, starts to be checked. What are the properties of Harry? What are the properties of whichever definition of Java you tend to use? Do any of them make sense? If they don't, it's an incorrect sentence or potentially an incorrect program. We'll then translate, saying, this is what the human wrote, and this is the operations, the actual actions done by a computer. So up to here, we were doing this analysis. Starting down here, we're doing translation. What's different from an if statement, a while statement, an assignment statement, a read statement, a write statement? It's what the actual generated code does. So we'll talk about a translator. I'll talk about in passing optimization. We don't do much of that, but there's always the question is when you're writing a program, can I make it more efficient? There's lots of ways of doing that. For example, one thing that oftentimes happens is there'll be blocks of code in a program that nobody ever uses. Why would that be the case? There might be debugging code. You might have been putting code in for an advanced feature that's not needed yet. Lots of possibilities. And what compilers oftentimes do say, if this is code and it's valid but it's not used, I'll simply throw it away. It can't hurt. Now, you're not throwing it away from the source, so you're not losing anything, but you're making the generated program more efficient. Well, you're saying to yourself, that's obvious. That any fool would do that. But it turns out that there are examples where a compiler doing that actually makes a program run slower. It's one of these mystic things. You think of compilers and computers as being perfectly objective, rational machines. It's not at all true in all cases. In some cases, if I change the location of a bit of code ever so slightly, the program can run visibly faster or visibly slower. Why is that? Well, it turns out one of the ways programs become real fast is that at the hardware level, you have things called caches. If you ever brought a processor and you say, oh, it's got an L1 cache and an L2 cache and an L3 cache, L1 meaning level 1, level 2, and level 3, but it also has an I cache, that's for instructions. It has a D cache, that's for data. And it turns out if these caches are used wisely, a program runs real fast. If they're used not so wisely, it runs palpably slower. So it's actually possible that by removing a piece of unneeded code, you cause pieces of code to change their location just enough that the program runs slower. It's one of these things that shouldn't be. Computers should be science. Doing good things should make good things happen. But one of the things we've learned long ago is no good deed ever goes unpunished. And that's true in almost every area of endeavor, and certainly true in computing. So finally, we'll get down to the code generator. You won't do any optimization unless you want to do a little extra credit. And I'll tell you about some obvious optimization. They're not always hard to do, but maybe some extra credit. And finally, we'll generate code. This will be for the Java virtual machine that we can actually assemble into actual .class files, just exactly as a Java compiler would, and run it on any Java platform you want. So once your compiler is running with your language, you can run it anywhere Java runs. So that's pretty cool. You can get your programs to do things that Java wouldn't otherwise do. Maybe that's wise, maybe it's unwise, but it's still possible. Okay, reading assignment, that's really for next time. Chapter 3 has to do with scanning. By the end of today's marathon session, I'll be at the stage where I'll probably be starting a little bit on tokens and scanning, but we'll get the bulk of that next week, and that'll allow you to prepare for your next project step, which will be released 2 weeks from today. It's actually released now, but 2 weeks from today, project one is done, and you can then start worrying about project two. Okay, scanner, that's the first thing we're going to be doing. I've already stolen some of my own thunder, but let's talk about that. It seems like it's a baby sort of program, but it's really not nearly as simple as you might imagine. And in fact, one of the things about scanners is exactly what you can assume and what not. And that's true in a lot of cases. Well, there was a famous philosopher, a British philosopher named Benny Hill. And people may have seen that, and they're not much anymore. But Benny Hill used to always have a great little routine. He says, whenever you assume, anybody tell me what the rest, what's he say after that? Whenever you assume, what happens? You make an ass out of you and me. And you say, that's actually remarkably true. I have a colleague at the university who's made a name for himself by just finding frailties in software. Now, many of you are developers or users, and you know how ridiculously easy that is. People like to think of software as being bulletproof, and it's really not. If you do the dirty enough tricks, you can bring any piece of software down to its knees and without any difficulty. And one of the weaknesses a scanner might have, hopefully a generated one automatically wouldn't, but I bet you one that you wrote by hand would, is what if I throw characters at you that don't exist? Don't exist. What in the world does that mean? Well, if you've studied a little bit about how computers lay out data in memory, it turns out the basic unit of memory is a byte. And when you, read about having megabytes or gigabytes or terabytes, it's a byte. And what a byte is 8 bits, 8 zeros or 1s. And that's essentially the equivalent of having 256 different things. So 0 to 255, if you write them as a number, can be represented in one byte. Conveniently, a byte is a very handy to represent a single character on a typewriter. Except it's a little too convenient because it turns out the character set we mostly use, even today, if it goes way back when, is something called ASCII that has 128 combinations. But I have 256 possibilities. So it turns out in ASCII, usually the uppermost bit is not used. So because I only need 7 bits for 128. And that means if you take any program, including a number of scanners, and throw it bytes that have that high order bit set, crazy things can happen because you assumed that it was a valid character. And there are 128 of those from 0 to 127 in numeric form. But if you give those advanced ones and you're not expecting it, bad things can happen. So the upshot is even something as simple as scanning takes a lot of detail if you're going to do it right, if you're going to try to make a program as bulletproof as is possible. So what's the scanner going to do? It's going to take the individual characters, probably filter out the bad ones, and now I can see all these people planning tomorrow if I get bored, I'm going to take my favorite compiler, set some illegal bits and see if I can bring it to its knees or not. So, it'd be the thing, but don't boast too much about it because, again, it's so easy that almost anybody can do it if they make the effort. And someday, on an off thing, I'll tell you about how by doing those dirty tricks, I actually got to see the treasures of Tutankhamun. Now, years ago, they actually brought the King Tut treasures to the United States. And since I'm never likely to go to Egypt, I got the one and only chance to see them. So I was up close and personal with that famous death mask that King Tut has and when you see and all that. And it was a remarkable situation there. I keep saying to myself, this was done 3,000 years ago when my ancestors and probably most of your ancestors were running naked through the forests of Europe, with a hammer or a club or something trying to kill whatever bears or wild boars or whatever they had. And here are these Egyptians doing this remarkable art. So anyway, I'll tell you at another time how by doing dirty tricks, I actually got to see King Tut. See, sometimes nasty actions do have good returns. So it turns out that a scanner will also remove some unnecessary information. There's a lot in a program, things like comments, that aren't needed to translate it. That's not to say comments are bad. Please don't tell your manager that Professor Fisher said comments are bad, and therefore I don't have to do them. Comments are good, but they're good there for humans. As far as the compiler is concerned, they're not intelligible because They're written in human language, which is not understood, and therefore they can be thrown away as a way of simplifying the translation. It can also sometimes add preliminary information if I need to actually start populating, for example, a symbol table early on. That varies by the language. And occasionally you can go ahead and format and list a program. We'll actually have something in our parser later on that does that, something called an unparser, kind of an interesting idea. So one of the things I'll get to on this is that, as I said, we need a precise definition for how tokens are represented. And this is a case where it's kind of odd if you think about the history of human endeavor, intellectual endeavor. There's been a huge amount done in mathematics. And I remember when I was a youngster, the original Twilight Zones were coming on. And at the beginning of the old Twilight Zones, they used to have the old E equals MC squared. And my father didn't know much mathematics or science, was awestruck by this. Oh my gosh, you know, this is great science. Isn't this the secret to atomic power and ruling the world and all that? But it's something that exists, and almost all of you have taken enough science to have seen this, and superscripts are not that unusual. But probably many of you have also seen more advanced in mathematics. And believe me, I'm not requiring that you do it. I just want to show it to make a point. So I might have sigma from I equals 1 to infinity of 1 over 2 to the I. That's pretty, and that's an easy thing to write down, but it's a remarkably powerful notation because infinity, I actually have written down a summation for an infinite number of terms. Turns out also this is one way to represent a very well-known number. So what does 1/2 plus 1/4 plus 1/8 blah, 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 blah represent in the limit? 1. So say, darn fool, why don't you just write down 1? It's because mathematicians like to show how clever they are. But here's what's missing, is why don't we have a similar notation like this for something that all of us use much more often, namely language, words, characters. So I can write down an infinite number of terms that sum to 1, but suppose I wanted to write down something that says, give me a definition or a pattern that represents 5-letter words that begin with an E and end with an A. You know, something you might find in a crossword puzzle or maybe on Jeopardy or something like that. There's no standard notation for doing that. And yet, since we manipulate words all the time, there probably ought to be. We'll be doing it for scanning. You could do it for crossword puzzles. Turns out that these things appear in all sorts of unexpected places. So many of you own cars, some very nice cars I've seen. Do any of you have vanity license plates? Does anybody have Epic, for example? I assume there must be Epic or Epic, you know, Inc. or something like that. Does Judy have that or somebody have that? I mean, it's so obvious somebody's taken it. Well, anyway, so it turns out, you know, that there are these vanity plates. You can go down and pay an extra fee and get a plate. But what you probably haven't been told, and you think about it a little bit, is that there are rules about what can be generated, issued. For example, you obviously can't use some obscene 4-letter words. But these days, to be politically correct, there are various things that you might want to filter out or might not. So we're almost to February, and a good thing about February is that spring training begins. So I might want to go ahead and try to get a plate like this. And let's say I try to get it in Wisconsin. I don't know if they'd issue it to me or not, but why might that be objectionable? What do the first 2 letters really say? It's not H8, it is what? Hate. And no, I really don't, you know, so any Cub fans here, Cubs are going to have a good team this year, and, you know, don't come back at me at the fall and say, ha ha, we beat you. But if you're trying to filter these things, just imagine how much easier it would be if you could write a program that would take what the person is asking for and filter it out, things that are potentially troublesome. What makes that difficult is these things change. For example, you're all much younger than I, and are there any new jargon words that might be problematic? Don't give me things that are obscene or going to get me fired or put a thing there, but is there any word that just come out that if I was doing a filter for vanity plates, I ought to watch out for? Instead of saying H8, there must be some. I mean, the language is always changing. You don't want to admit you would know it, right? But is there? Nymph, yeah, something. Okay, yeah, I mean, that's exactly the sort of thing. So my point is not that you want to program this, but isn't it odd that we don't have a notation so that just like I could write a program that sums fractions, you know, in situation there, there's a program you can buy, a fairly expensive one called Mathematica, that does advanced mathematics and would notice that this thing is equal in the limit to one and be able to tell you that sort of thing. There's much more complex ones. But there's this other notation that I'll help develop that essentially allows us to build tokens, but also to recognize patterns of characters for things like filtering suspicious vanity plates, you know, something like this, you might not, the obvious sort of ones, you know, that are plain out obscene, or sometimes people take an obscene word and change one letter or something. A lot of that would have to be done. And there ought to be a way to simply specify what it is you want or don't want. So something as simple as saying, here are character sequences, here's what's good and here's what's bad, is not as easy as it sounds until we develop some notation. And that's what I'll be doing very soon. Once we get done with scanning, our next process will be a parser. And a parser will be something that says, here are the exact rules of what's allowed or what's not allowed. And again, it's one of those situations where you as a designer get to decide. So as an example of that, and I got all sorts of examples, but situation is that you've all seen assignment statements like A equals B plus C. And that's an assignment statement, and there'll be a rule that essentially says the target of an assignment must be the name of a variable. And the source can be any legal expression, a simple one or more complex one. What they don't tell you is, although this is the way it does in programming languages, almost all programming languages, including the ones we know, have it backwards. This is not the way assignment statements should go. This is the way assignment statements should actually go. The source and the target ought to be reversed. Now, question is, why should it be this way? And second question is, why isn't it? Why should it be this way? Well, notice how programs normally work is they evaluate things bit by bit as they encountered them. In this particular case, what does an assignment statement say? It says evaluate the right-hand side and then assign it to the left-hand side. Except now, of course, I've inverted those. So if we were writing it the way it operates, it would say compute this guy. Okay, now you got it, and plug him into there. So that's the way programming language should go. If you want to change your programming language, you can do it, but it's going to be a hard sell to convince people at this stage that it ought to be done differently. So the question is, why is it done that way instead of the other way? Does anybody have any ideas? No, it's even simpler than that. It's easier for people to read because that's the way it's done in mathematics and engineering and science texts. Just think of all things. Remember I even had it here and I wasn't even thinking I had it. E equals mc squared. You've seen equations like that all the time where something equals something else, but the more complex thing comes first. They could have written mc squared equals e. Maybe they do in some languages, but certainly it's nothing I'm familiar with. So as we develop syntax, we're going to have to decide what we want and enforce it, but then we have to have explanations, perhaps, of why we've done it the way it is done. But here's the cool part about doing this. We're going to have something where we specify what the structures that are legal are, but we'll have a tool that will automatically build a parser. And the great thing about building the parser is that's the key to building this abstract syntax tree. So far, I've given you a break. I said, here's an abstract syntax tree, and it's valid. But that means all the components are plugged in and filled in. This guy's linked to that guy, and everybody's in the right place. How do I know that that's valid? How can I guarantee that I'm using a valid abstract syntax tree? If I have an invalid one, I'm going to go crazy because things are going to be in unexpected places. And the answer is I don't have to worry about programming it. I have to worry about having the parser build it for me. So as I go along, I'll say, Mr. Parser, hey, you've just found an assignment, have you? And let's assume we do it the old-fashioned way. So what I'll say is at this stage, you go ahead and figure out what the abstract syntax tree for that is. Figure out what the abstract syntax tree for that is. And that's good, because that's not my job. I'm the guy doing the assignment. Everybody else, go and do your job. Don't bother me. Do it right. And if you don't do it right, I'm going to get you. All I have to do is do my job right. And it says, okay, you've gone ahead and build a tree for A. I don't know what it is. If it's wrong, I'm going to rat you out to the boss and you're going to be in trouble. The right-hand side, you better build it right. Otherwise, I'm going to complain. And all I have to do is create an abstract syntax tree that has an assignment node. And I'll take whatever you gave me and plug it in. And whatever you gave me for the right-hand side and plug it in. And that's all I have to do. So on a step-by-step basis, building trees is pretty easy if everybody else builds his or her trees correctly. And again, this is this nice notion of each individual piece is easy to program and easy to understand. And because of that, I can have confidence that a big monster tree, if you go to a major size program, it's going to have at least as many nodes as you have symbols in the program. Because almost all those symbols are going to be leaves, and there's going to be interconnectors, there's going to be null nodes and all that. We don't worry about memory anymore. But the complexity of this, how do I know it's right? And the way you know it's right is because you're not building a tree with 1,000 nodes. You're building a tree with 1 or 2 nodes and doing it 1,000 times. And there's a big difference to that. If you do little steps, each of them right, in combination, how can you go wrong? At least that sounds pleasant. And that's actually the way we're going to go ahead and do it. The type checker is one that's less automated because here more human rules come into play. But here where we start using these rules that say, if I'm trying to do arithmetic, I have to have arithmetic values. So if, for example, I try to write something down like bool b and int a, oh, come on, guys. Sorry about that. And I wrote down A plus B. Neither the scanner nor the parser are going to complain about this guy, but the type checker will in most languages because there's no rule in most languages that say how to add an integer to a Boolean. Now, some early languages like C cheated a little bit, and they said a Boolean is not really a type by itself. It's a byte, and a byte's an integer. 0 or 1 to represent a Boolean, and I can add bytes to integers. That was bad design. They were trying to use too much of the information about how something is implemented and not enough about the rules. But more modern languages like Java, they say, uh-oh, wait a minute, Booleans are not numbers. You want to convert it to a number, go ahead and do it, but you can't add Booleans to numbers because it's not defined. And that, of course, is done so that casual or unintentional errors are detected rather than allowed to slip through with potentially difficult results because it looks reasonable perhaps and is allowed, but it shouldn't have been. So our type checker will do that. And that means it's going to go ahead and fill in information to the tree about types. Types are very important because rich languages have all sorts of types. Integer, Boolean, char, strings, and in Java, all these classes that can exist. And different types interact in different ways. So it's going to be able to have to figure that out. And that's something you'll get to implement. That'll be step 4 of your assignment. And finally, we'll get to the point where we say, hey, I'm pretty sure I've got a valid program. Its tokens are correct. Its syntax is correct. No type errors. Let's go ahead and translate it into something that's executable. Now, of course, you all know at this point, unlike people first learning programming, that does not mean that the program is in fact correct. Just because Mr. Compiler does not say error does not mean it's valid. All it means is that it'll execute and do something. All we do as compiler writers say, we're going to give you what you asked for, whether it makes sense in the big picture or not, because you wrote the program and you asked for the result. And now we'll have to ask questions about whether or not certain programming constructs are allowed or not. It used to be in the old days that somebody who wrote a program that ran forever gotten themselves in trouble because no programs are supposed to run forever. Those are the old days. Can anybody think of programs that are supposed to run forever today? Are there any? If I want to write one and it says, hey, this is never going to stop, why would that possibly be valid? That's right. I mean, just think of something like many of you, when you go on your Go Live trips, do they fly or do they make you take the Greyhound bus? Do you get to fly? Yeah, good. You probably go through O'Hare sometimes. O'Hare is one of those airports that is up 24/7. And if it ever goes down, it's all by bad weather, not by intention. But even more important, you're in the healthcare industry. There are all sorts of medical devices which are now implantable. For a long time, it's been possible for someone to get a pacemaker implanted in their chest. And as you might imagine, these days, anything like that has a program in it. And presumably, you can't say to this person, I'm going to stop the pacemaker while I reload a program. Please don't mind if your heart stops pumping. We'll get you up and going as soon as we can. That's certainly not allowed. So certain programs have to run forever. Well, I won't get into it, but maybe someday you will. How do you maintain programs that have to run forever? It's not a frivolous thing. People who have implants, like a heart pacemaker, don't want it stopped. It's a very dangerous thing if it does. And yet, at some point, a program may need to be updated. There might be a bug that somebody missed that has to be corrected. Or there might be a better way of doing it to make the pacemaker work better. People have actually studied that there are ways to change a running program without stopping it. I won't get into that except to say that it's been studied, and my feeling is it'll be more and more important as computing gets more and more embedded. So we'll talk about that. In fact, I'm just a little bit over, so let's go ahead, and this would be a good place to take a break. And remember, last time what happens is it's 6:30. We'll take a break until 4:45. I'll do another hour session, take another 4:45 break, and then get you out of here by about 8:30. So anybody who needs to do a pit stop or, like me, get a big gulp, please go ahead and...